Chapter 14. The Magic Book. It is not possible here to transcribe more than a few extracts from the book on which my attention was now completely riveted. The passages selected are chosen simply because they may be useful to those few who desire to make of their lives something more than a simple buy-and-sell game, and also because these passages are relatively easy to understand. When Paracelsus wrote The Secret of Long Life, he did so in a fashion sufficiently complex and abstruse as to frighten away all but the most persevering of his students. This was no doubt his intention. But the instructions given in the volume placed here for my perusal were simple and accorded with many of the facts we all know from the discoveries of modern science. As I read, I began to see light behind the darkness and to gain a perception of the way in which I might become an adept in what the world deems miraculous, but which, after all, is nothing but the application of actual common experience. To begin with, I will quote the following, headed, Life and Its Adjustment. Life is the divine impetus of love. The force behind the universe is love. And from that love is bred all desire and all creativity. Some desire causes delusion, but not all. When love is rightly directed, it awakens divine devotion and an eagerness to find new and ever higher ways of serving the Supreme Being. Even as the human lover craves to possess his beloved, resulting in the children born of mutual tenderness, so the divine spirit embraces space with eternal energy to produce millions of solar systems, each one with its own different and special energy, its own specific individuality. Man, the most developed creature on our small planet Earth, is one result of the resistless output of the divine fecundity. Man is, nevertheless, made in the image of God, for he has intelligent self-awareness. Why then should he not train his thoughts to stand as upright as his body, that it may express every power that spiritual energy can provide? Reader and student, you for whom these words are written, learn and remember that the secret of strength and renewal is perpetual adjustment and readjustment, adjustment to what is, ever casting aside what habit has caused one merely to wish were the case, adjustment to the insights of the soul rather than to the imperative desires of ego. Become the god of your own universe. Control your own solar energy that it may warm and revivify you with an ever-recurring spring. Make love the source of your life, letting it create within you a summer passion of noble desires. Let wisdom fill you with the autumn perception of a season joy. Let faith bring you a winter of untouched inner life. Know yourself to be a part of the divine spirit, and let divinity infuse your own experience, making it ever creative. The whole universe is open to the searchings of your soul, if love be the torch that lights your way. Having read thus far, I paused. The little room in which I sat appeared darker, or was it my fancy? I listened for the voices which had so distressed and worried me, but there was no sound. I turned the pages of the book before me and found the following. The Action of Thought. Thought is an actual motive force, more powerful than any other in the world. It exists not in the mere pulsations of your brain, destined to pass quickly into nothingness when the pulsations cease. Thought is an echo of states of consciousness in the universe. Just as the human voice is transmitted over great distances by the medium of the telephone, so are your thoughts reflections of ideas passing through the universe, and depend on the level of consciousness from which you invite them. One cannot be a genius. One can only invite the inspirations of genius to enter his consciousness by living on the level of thought that is compatible with that inspiration. His brain receives that inspiration. It cannot create it. Moreover, it can never keep that inspiration as its own, for all one's thoughts are transmitted constantly to other brains. You can no more keep a thought to yourself than you can acquire a monopoly on sunlight. Everywhere, in all the worlds throughout the universe, souls are communing through the mere medium of the brain. Souls that may not inhabit this world, that may be so far away from us as the farthest star visible to the strongest telescope. The harmonies that suggest themselves to the musician on Earth today may have fallen from Sirius or Aldebaran, striking on his earthly brain with a spiritual sweetness from worlds unknown. The poet writes what he scarcely realizes, obeying the inspiration of his dreams. All of us are only mediums for the conveying of thought. We may receive them from other spheres. We then transmit them to others. Shakespeare, the great poet, received his poetry from higher spheres than those on which he lived. As we think, so we are, and thought resolves itself into action. Therefore, encourage thoughts of happiness. Avoid all persons who talk of or manifest disease, misery, and decay. These things are the actual causes of human crime. Negative thoughts are offenses against God's design for the universe. Drink deep draughts of sunshine and fresh air. Inhale the perfume of flowers and trees. Keep yourself as far away from cities and from crowds as possible. Note the fact that otherwise well-meaning persons have been known in crowds to cry for would-be suicide standing on a ledge to jump. Seek no wealth that has not been earned by your own hand or brain. Remember, above all things, that those who recognize the light within them can walk without fear of darkness. Something in this last sentence made me stop and look again around me. Again, it seemed to me that the room was growing darker, and not only darker, but smaller. The purple silk hangings which draped the walls were almost within my touch. I knew they had not been so close to me when I sat down to read. A nervous tremor ran through me, but I resolved not to be the dupe of my own fancy. Thus I set myself resolutely once more to the study of the volume before me. The next paragraph that attracted me was headed, "On the Command of Life's Forces." It began thus. To live long, you must have command over the forces that engender life. The atoms of which your body is composed are in perpetual movement. Your spiritual self must guide them in the way they should go. If you let them succumb to negativity, they will resemble an army without a leader and be easily put to rout by a first assault. If you have your own army under your spiritual control, you will make yourself immune to disease. Disease can enter your system only through some undefended opening. Yes, you may meet with accident, by others' fault or by your own willfulness. If so, you have only yourself to blame. You can live a long, clear-minded, and healthy life if you keep yourself filled with divine energy. As for poverty, no true adept is ever poor. Poverty cannot exist where the mind is ever cheerful and ever full of faith and energy. Gladness, peace, and plenty must naturally attend souls that are in tune with nature. Life is always perpetuated by joy in living. Stand, therefore, ever erect, ever firm. Let the force radiating from your soul possess every nerve and blood vessel of your body. Learn, with that strength which compels obedience, to command all things that pertain to that which is good. Not idly did the great Master Jesus speak when he told his disciples that if their faith were but as a grain of mustard seed, they might command that a mountain be cast into the sea, and it would be so. With God, all things are possible. I raised my head from its bent position over the book and drew a long breath. Something oppressed me almost to suffocation, and looking up, I saw that I was being steadily closed in as if in a contracting cage. The little room, draped with its soft purple hangings, was already too small for me to move about in. I was pinned to my chair, and the ceiling seemed to be descending upon me. With a shock of horrified memory, I recalled the old torture of the living tomb practiced by the Spanish Inquisition, when the wretched victim was compelled to watch the walls of his prison slowly shrinking around him, inch by inch, till he was crushed to death. How could I be sure that no such cruelties existed among the mysterious members of this brotherhood with whom I dwelt, and whose avowed object of study was to search out the secret of life? I remembered that the villagers below had spoken ill of them. I made an effort to rise and found that I could stand upright. There, straight before me, was the entrance to my room, from which I had wandered into this small inner chamber. It seemed easy enough to get to the room, and yet I found myself hindered by some invisible barrier. I stood, my heart beating nervously, wondering what it was that threatened me. Almost involuntarily, my eyes perused again the printed page before me, and in a kind of waking dream, I read the following sentences. To the soul that will not study its immortal nature, life itself becomes a narrow prison. All God's creation waits to supply that soul with what it needs, yet in the midst of plenty, it starves. Fear, suspicion, distrust, anger, envy, and callousness to others' pleas paralyze its being and destroy its ability to act. Love, courage, patience, sweetness, generosity, and sympathy are actual life forces that would sustain it and the body it inhabits. All the influences of society work against it. All the influences of the natural world work with it. There is nothing in pure nature that will not obey the soul's behest. This should be sufficient for its happy existence. Sorrow and despair result from the misuse of the will. On earth or in heaven, there is no other cause for suffering. Misuse of the will? I spoke the words aloud, then went on reading. What is heaven on earth? It is a state of perfect happiness. What is true happiness? It is immortal union in God. Here, on a sudden impulse, I closed the book and held it clasped in my two hands. As I did so, a great darkness overwhelmed me, and a sound like thunder crashed upon my hearing. I felt the whole room reeling into chaos. The floor sank and I sank with it, down to a great depth so swiftly that I had no time to think what was happening. Suddenly, the sensation of falling ceased abruptly, and I found myself in a narrow green lane, completely shadowed by the wide boughs of overarching trees. I beheld suddenly before me an angelic form. It saw me and said with a contemptuous sneer, "What have we to do with you?" Stunned and bewildered, I tried to walk a few paces, and though I found the ground under my feet soft as velvet, and there was a cool breeze blowing through the trees that refreshed my aching forehead and eyes, I felt miserably rejected, and, worst of all, rejected by God. I still held the book, the secret of life, and thought in a dull, aimless manner, how useless everything is. What does life matter, I ask myself, if it rejects me? The sun was shining somewhere above me, for I saw glinting reflections of it through the close-knit boughs. The birds were singing. Both beauty of sight and sound, however, were lost to me. I had no real awareness left, save that God had rejected me. My world was desolate, and heaven itself a blank. I walked slowly and with difficulty. My limbs were languid, and all courage had left me. If I could find my way to Aselzion, I would tell him, "This is enough. No more do I want anything. I am content to be represented by one of your black crosses in that garden." Then, suddenly, I beheld two people walking in the narrow lane. They seemed happy together, and on seeing me, smiled welcomingly. "Greetings, pilgrim," they said. "Is it not wonderful how much God loves us all? We just met an angel who said to us, 'I've lately seen a woman alone, and I asked her, how can I help you?' And she walked away without answering. Are you that woman?" Stunned, I heard them, but could not comprehend. Then, as I thought further on the matter, I realized that the angel's words, "What have we to do with you?" had expressed concern, not contempt. What she had said was, "What can we do for you?" Oh, I thought, how can we so delude ourselves? I had come from a black mood, and all therefore had seemed black. I resolved to remember how much of what we see is a projection of ourselves. I continued walking until I came to a beach.